Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams podcast. Joining me this time out, a lady who needs no introduction, though I will give her a brief one because it's a very courteous thing to do. Danielle DiMartino-Booth is the CEO and Chief Strategist of QI Research LLC. She's a former Federal Reserve insider working closely with Richard Fisher at the Dallas Fed. And before that, a very well-respected journalist for the Dallas Morning News. She's joining me at a time where there is so much to talk about and we are reaching a point where so many cross currents are coming together. So I wanted to get Danielle's views on that, not least because a big part of that is the dilemma facing the Federal Reserve. And there aren't many people who understand that dilemma as well as Danielle. So here we go. Here's my conversation with Danielle DiMartino-Booth. Danielle, lovely to see you as always. Thanks for coming back to the show.
It's great to be here today. How are you?
I'm doing very, very well, thank you. You're home in Dallas for a change.
I am home in Dallas. I just got back from, I flew out of Detroit. I've seen the Midwest. I've seen Children Row Crew regattas in the past few months. I've been Columbus, Cincinnati, Skokie, Illinois. Skokie. You got to get there one day. Yeah. All and right outside Ann Arbor, Michigan. So I've seen it all.
Fantastic. And you are certainly not the first or the last person to say I flew out of Detroit. That's been happening for quite a while now, as far as I can figure out.
And I want to talk about households and autos, so we can go there.
Perfect. Well, listen, there's always so much to talk about. And I think I want to kick things off, give you a very general question, because I know that your answer is going to give us plenty of stuff to dive into. And that is your big picture assessment of the position that the Federal Reserve currently find themselves in, with all the cross currents of data, all the cross currents of market odds, of pivots and hikes and cuts and all that kind of stuff. Give us a very broad overview of where you think they currently stand and where the pressure points are.
So, I go back to average inflation targeting, and I think that that's where the Fed staff started to lead Powell astray. And I think that's where his chapter of humiliation in his life opens. Is it that Jackson Hole? And it closed a few Jackson Holes later with an 8-minute and 42-second speech. And by then he had been run through the ringer. The world thought he was a pawn. They thought he was worse about QE than Bernanke or Yellen or Greenspan. And something snapped in him after the whole transitory narrative finally fell away. And it's kind of important that you understand that in November the 21st, 2021, he was finally renominated, but he's not confirmed until May 12th of 2022. We've never seen an administration hang somebody out to dry like that in such an obvious public fashion. So, Jay Powell's a lawyer. He's not stupid. He understands that the jobs opening data is nothing. He understands it's garbage. He understands his super core inflation is garbage. And yet he's hiding behind what he knows to be highly lagged data. He's really not taking the counsel of the Fed staff anymore. He's got his lieutenants, Christopher Waller, John Williams at the New York Fed. There are people who speak directly for him who are out there. Some people are on a different spectrum, but there are two individuals who actually speak for him, and they're maintaining that the Fed is going to stay tight. Just before we started recording, I said, well, we've got chances of a rate hike back up to, they've round tripped north of 21%, which is where they were headed into the CPI report that showed that inflation is softening. It's not going to soften. It has softened. And again, Powell's no longer taking the direction of the academics, the PhDs. And Powell knows that trueflation's out there, TRU-flation, which all my bond trader, interest rate trader, institutional clients follow trueflation. Well, trueflation on April 10th was 4.49%, and now it's like literally 100 basis points lower by the time we get to mid-May, 3.49%, and it's coming down very quickly. So I postulate that Powell knows he's hiding behind these because I think he's trying to break the Fed put. And I mean, I'm public enemy number one right now on my own Twitter feed. People are like, no, he's going to pivot. That's what they do. They pivot. Damn you. He's going to run the economy into the ground. And I'm like, the economy is going to run itself into the ground if we can't get off this merry-go-round of the only way, you know, our third world country can exist is at the zero bound with the Fed monetizing every penny, in which case you don't need a Fed. The central bank becomes completely irrelevant if that is the sole operating premise. That can be absorbed into the treasury. They can keep the open markets operations in New York so that they can monetize all the treasuries. AOC, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, they can all get together and have a party and roll out a central bank digital currency and pay for everything. And then we can stop talking about deflationary impulses because we'll have the mother of all inflationary spirals. But you don't need a Fed for that. You don't. You don't need a central bank to say, well, we think we're going to keep interest rates at zero, and we think we're going to monetize every penny of treasuries that's auctioned off. So let's talk about that. Nothing to talk about at all. Just go away. And I've never been an end the Fedder, and I'm not suggesting we end the Fed. I'm just saying I think we're at a juncture where we're seeing insolvencies just go bananas. We're in a place and time where if he managed to pull a Bernanke and go back to the zero bound and restart QE, I don't even think that's enough, Grant. I've got a mortgage buddy. He's like, yeah, you'd have to get the 30-year fix down to 1.5%. You want people to move? Get the 30-year fix mortgage rate down to 1.5%, which is negative nominal rates. Again, you don't need a Federal Reserve for that.
Are we finally at the point where the rubber meets the road? Because, you know, we've talked and written about this for years and years and years and talked about where these policies would ultimately lead to. And, you know, you talk about Powell, you know, hiding behind whatever, and he's a lawyer and he's smart and he knows the game. There is famous Fed meeting minutes from 2012 where he was absolutely clear that he understood exactly not just the rules of the game, but what the Fed was doing by allowing the market to front run what they would promise they were going to do. And that was what gave me the inspiration to tweet at the time, I actually quite like Jay Powell. And that backfired horribly when he came out and was kind of co-opted immediately, right out the gate, basically, back in 2018. So are we finally at the point where the rubber meets the road and the really tough decisions have to be made? And if so, who makes them? Because it's hard to see that, as you say, that the Fed will.
Well, I think that Jay Powell is willing to make these decisions if he survives. Right. So the crucification of Jay Powell has gone from being in the financial media with nasty Bloomberg headlines, vilifying him, to mainstream. And, you know, once the mainstream media going into an election year decides this is the fall guy, this is the bad guy, we've identified him, he's going to go down with the ship. Once that happens, you know, the odds are that the clock is ticking. Now, I think to hold the institution together, I think that legal precedent suggests that even if Biden was to attempt to fire Powell for cause, while the case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, because that's what precedent tells us, because this is the head of a federal agency. So we don't have anybody threatening the chair of the Federal Reserve in the past, but you've had other presidents take down heads of agencies, and the Supreme Court's very specific about this. Anyways, my point is the board can opt at that point to say, well, we're going to wait and see how the Supreme Court rules, and we're going to keep Powell at the helm. Now, that works if Powell doesn't suffer mutiny on his own board between now and then. And for the moment, he's got everybody pretty much towing the line. You had Bostic out on the wire saying that even if we are at a pause point, that does not translate into lowering interest rates at all in 2023. We're going to go well into 2024 before we even consider that. And that's what's essential, because you ask the question, are we at that point? Well, the answer is yes. The answer is yes if KKR, Apollo, Blackstone. The answer is yes if public pensions have to mark to market. We are at that moment. And public pensions can diversify away from alternatives. We're at that moment because the non-banking sector that's $239 trillion outstanding compared to the conventional banking system, which is $180 trillion outstanding globally. That non-banking sector operates only at the zero bound with hyper leverage and no covenants. And we've we don't have to play in that pit anymore. Pensions don't have to kowtow to that anymore because the next generations of private credit, they're not going to have any leverage. They're going to have beautiful yields. So as I was saying a few days ago, you could have an 80-20 portfolio, 80% in risk-free assets that pay, and then whole loans with no leverage in private credit. You get a blended 9% return on your portfolio as a pension, and you've sloughed off the heavy, super heavy fees and illiquidity factor of private equity itself, of these alternatives. It's revolutionary if Powell can hold the line.
Well, it is revolutionary, but it's also a giant step back in time to where, you know, and how the whole thing used to work. But the getting from here to there, obviously there's that sticky little issue of how do you divest yourself of these illiquid assets and get yourself into the high yielding. You know, we saw CalPERS actually move before everybody about a year ago and divest some of their private equity stuff at a 20% discount, I might add, quite visibly. What you just described, you know, is what I've been talking about. These yields on risk-free assets are an absolute game changer because they take the risk away from fiduciaries and they mm-hmm. give them a real return that after decades of, let's face it, gains they should never have been awarded. And I will say awarded, they didn't earn them. They were awarded them by monetary policy, essentially.
No doubt.
But how do we get from one to the other without an immensely turbulent period?
That's the thing. And this is where I get really unpopular. People keep saying, you know, he's going to decimate the little guy. I'm like, they're decimated. And every time you kick the can, the inequality divide widens further and further and further. I'm like, so if we got to go through this, why don't we take us all down, including the fat cats? You know, to use an analogy, why don't we take down the GPs, the general partners who've never been taken down, only the limited partners. And when the limited partners come down, then the inequality divide widens even more when the little guy has to pay the price, but Stephen Schwarzman gets to go off in his helicopter, wherever he wants to be, on his little private island or whatever. But again, Powell, this is going to be incredibly difficult. The only thing that's still on his side is financial conditions. It's a word that applies to too many things, but the stock market and high yield bond yields. High yield bond yields, they don't even reflect reality, right? They reflect 25, 30 energy names that trade. Big whoop-de-doo. We're not even seeing companies filing for Chapter 11 reflected in the level of distressed debt sitting out there. They're preemptively filing for Chapter 11. Seven of them did it in one day. The highest figure was in March of 2009, I want to say, when six companies with $50 million or more in liabilities filed Chapter 11. So we've just taken that out. And a lot of these companies don't have, their maturity wall doesn't come until 2024. They're looking at these property companies that are walking away from skyscrapers and doing the jingle mail thing because they know that they'll never, the difference between the bid and the ask is never going to close.
Right.
CFOs are like, oh, wait, we're never going to be able to refinance. So why don't we just preemptively, while there's still something still there to restructure, file. But the amount of chaos that eventually ensues is the biggest unknown. I retweeted out this morning the corollary on the household side. People had their mortgage payments on hold for years. People had their car payments on hold for at least a year. I had somebody on my Twitter feed actually asking for money because her mortgage payment had gone from like $1,500 to $3,400. Because once the clock started ticking again, even though her payments were piled onto the end of her mortgage, the escrow happened all at once. And at the same time, you know, they're like, what do you mean my used car that's 140% upside down LTV loan? What do you mean it needs a new carburetor? What's a carburetor? I lived in the city 3 years ago. I took the subway. What do you mean my air conditioner? Definitely my air conditioner is broken. But what do you mean it costs $5,000 to replace it? So there's an entire generation that squandered out of urban cities that have no clue about what it costs to own a home, beyond the payment they squeezed into, what it costs to own a car. I mean, you look at the PPI for auto insurance, it's still vertical. I spent the last weekend talking to my mentor, Lacey Hunt, going back and forth. Why did those University of Michigan in 5 to 10 year inflation expectations right. tick up to 3.2%, just a tenth shy of their highest? Because you've got an entire generation that is discovering. The millennials are in a price discovery mode right now, and they don't like it. And they know that these things are long life. So prices at the pump, food prices, airfares, hotels, we're seeing disinflation everywhere we can look. And yet what they know their obligations are years out. The costs are just insurmountable in their minds. And we've already seen from EPIQ, Epic, we've already seen personal bankruptcy filings year over year. Beginning in January, we're going to see a wave of personal bankruptcy filings.
So, you know, with all that as background, and it's the perfect background, because I think it lays out just about every serious problem that we face. There are two paths here. So let's map both paths out. There's the path where Jay Powell sticks to his guns. The Fed decide they have to break the back of inflation. They channel their inner Paul Volcker and they stay the course and they start jawboning and they talk like Bostic has about, we're going to be way into 2024. We're not going to raise anymore, but we're not cutting. We're going to keep rates up here until we can get this thing properly under control.
And keep shrinking the balance sheet.
And keep shrinking the balance sheet, right? And if you look at what's happening in the wages part of the component, particularly service wages, you realize the extent of this problem because that's really just getting started. And while the goods inflation has come down, services, nah. And the wage hikes you're starting to see people demand now are starting to reflect exactly what you just laid out. And then there's the other path where they buckle, they start cutting, and they try and ameliorate all the concerns you've just laid out. Now, ultimately, the first path probably at some point leads to the second path. But let's try and map out that first path first, how you see it going, if they do manage to stay the course and if they do manage to materially break the back of this, what does the world look like?
It's going to feel like a depression and it's going to be very abrupt in nature. Non-residential construction projects will just be abandoned. Mm-hmm. You will see a shock to construction payrolls. Again, the word I keep falling back on is how abrupt, we're going to see an abrupt shift up in the unemployment rate. And companies will simply give way. And that's why I'm saying we're seeing companies go from being not rated junk to filing Chapter 11. It's the abruptness of all of this. And if you look inside the entrails of wholesale sales is, you know, that's the pipeline in the economy to services and goods. Mm-hmm. If you net out oil, because oil is extremely volatile in wholesale, but if you net that out of wholesale inventories in data back to 1992, we've never had the wholesale sales to inventory ratio of 1.55. When you remove out of those 19 industries or so, just the one of oil, we're in uncharted territory. You have a generation of operations managers, they're Googling destocking because they don't understand why the people that they sell to aren't even replacing what their normal pace of purchases are. I'm seeing something in pulp and corrugated that I've never seen. Chemicals prices, these are all at the very leading edge. And just today, Empire State came out, you know, expectations for capital expenditures, which never turn negative, period. You're asking somebody running a firm, are you planning on building something in the next decade? And they're saying, no, 0.1% is the reading. It's on the cusp of turning negative. So we're talking about the reversal of an investment cycle, but it's going to feel very, very abrupt because financial conditions have told us that everything is fine.
Now, when you talk about that abruptness, you know, obviously there's been this kind of wrestling match going on between the expectations for recessions based on the yield curve. And I mean, we've reached such extremes on that now that anyone that watches that is basically saying a recession is baked in the cake. And then we're looking at the employment situation and we're seeing something completely different. And not only in the US, but in the UK, we saw the Bank of England restate their GDP numbers, their GDP estimates for the next few years today. And even by their standards, it's shocking just how much they've had to revise growth up. The UK have taken all their actions based on a near certain recession, and they're now talking about significant growth in 23, 24, 25. So, you know, again, we're in this period of so many cross currents, and they're all very loud cross currents. When you talk about this abruptness, about this reconciliation of all these factors, is there any chance, do you think, that the abruptness is in a sharp return to growth, the Goldilocks landing? I'm not even going to call it a soft landing. We're way past soft landings now. But is the Goldilocks scenario at all possible? Because if it isn't, and I struggle to see how it is personally, if it isn't, then when this abruptness you talk about happens, it's only going to happen in one direction. And if the Fed allows it to get to that point, it's tough to see how even rate cuts can avert what they've begun.
And that is the linchpin. So I follow a guy by the name of Ben Herzon. He was at Macroeconomic Advisors in his past life. And then IHS Market bought Macroeconomic, then S&P Global bought IHS, whatever. I follow Ben Herzon because he invented the GDP model. He literally is the pioneer on the street. Decades and decades ago. So all the sell side firms, all the buy side firms, everybody models their GDP modeling after what Ben established. It's rare to see him move his numbers in any material way. You see Atlanta Fed GDP now, just it looks like it's got vertigo. Ben, methadone. It's just, I took it down by a tenth. So a few weeks ago, April 24th, they came out with annual revisions to retail sales. He took his GDP estimate for the first quarter from 1.9% to 0.9%.
Wow.
Because they slashed retail control spending. So that's retail sales minus food, gas, autos, and I think building supplies. Anyways, it's the retail figure that feeds GDP models. And to see him take his number down, and that solely reflected January and February retail sales, because the census was finally able to figure out what the real data were. And it makes perfect sense, right? Because January and February did not produce income tax refunds like the models that the census was using suggested that they would. So when reality hit, they had to go back and make these massive, but we won't know for a long time. That's why the National Bureau of Economic Research has been so quiet. But if we see a revision for March that's anything like what we saw for January and February of 2023, then we will be one quarter behind Germany going into recession. Nobody paid attention last week that German retail sales, industrial production, factory, everything was revised down. So going into last week, we were like, phew, Germany printed negative in Q4 2022, but they were unchanged in Q1 2023. That's changing after those revisions. So Germany is in a technical recession, which tells you what's happening in China,
yep,
which is important. And it looks like if we see revisions to March data, the United States followed Germany by a quarter and went into recession in the first quarter. Because his second quarter GDP estimate for 2023 is negative 0.1. And we're deep into this quarter.
Right.
So I think part of what's happening, especially in the UK, and you can tell me, but I think that their labor laws are a little bit more rigid. And I think that that's why we're seeing kind of surprise growth, if you will. But so many things, we've been waiting for the construction workers to be able to finally finish all these homes in the pipeline. But yet I talked to home builders and they're like, we're walking away from our land contracts. We're just walking away.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, especially with construction, the way that they model construction, which feeds GDP, is you're only allowed to have like 1.5% overage in any given non-residential project. These were seeing 20% overages that now they're having to come back and bake into higher GDP prior to 2023. So we're seeing upward revisions of the past, but that just tells you that the cliff was higher, that the economy fell off. Again, it's the abruptness, but the bean counters are having such a hard time. Whether it's the birth death model, we cut through all of that BS every single week at QI. We cut through all of it. And last week we passed the point of no return. If you have 70% or more U.S. states with rising initial claims for 3 months or longer, it has to persist. It can't be a blip. It can't be, but yep, for 3 months or longer, 70%, 82% of the population is seeing rising claims. We're in recession. We just don't know it. And the unemployment rate's not going to tell us anything for a while.
And it never does. That's the funny thing that people spend so much time focusing on it. But let's game out the other path, because you have great data. There are plenty of people out there with great data. And the one place we know that has access to every single piece of data is the Federal Reserve. They have all these PhDs on staff. They have access to all the data. They can see all this happening in real time. So let's game out what happens if they look at what you've just described and they see the writing on the wall and they think, right, we need to get ahead of this, which one would hope in a normally functioning world, central banks would occasionally be proactive rather than reactive, and they would try and avoid pain before it arrived and smooth out the cycles rather than just exacerbate them at both ends. But let's assume that they look at this data and go, okay, we need to get ahead of this. What happens? What happens if they start changing the messaging? They start talking softer. They start hinting at cuts. How does that world look? And does it actually change the outcome for all these things that you've just talked about being baked in the cake?
So I'm going to play Socrates for just a minute and ask you, what was required in March of 2020 to staunch the bleed? Was it monetary policy alone?
Well, no, exactly right. It's fiscal policy as well. But with the debt ceiling thing happening right now, it's very difficult to see there's any room for one, let alone the other. I mean, the other is going to be a real problem.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I keep reminding people. It's that it was not just the Fed and doing $100 billion of QE on a given day at the very beginning. Crazy stuff.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just that. It was $2,500 extra a month to not work. It was your rent being covered for 18, 19 months. In California, I think the rent's still being covered. It was the moratorium on auto payments. God, they covered COBRA. The CARES Act covered COBRA payments. Those are huge healthcare premiums if you lost your job. But everything was covered. And the other thing that I never, ever, ever get off my soapbox and tell people about is what also started with the CARES Act and was extended. Thank you, Joe Biden. And one of the reasons we feel like it's healthier than it is, why are the airports so crowded? Well, the employee retention credit, getrefunds.com. I mean, in the 34 months prior to July of 2020, that's kind of like the first time you could actually get that money in hand, this business income tax refund. Yep. It's a real thing. But in the 34 months that preceded it, business income tax refunds in the aggregate were $194 billion. In the 34 months that have followed, $400 billion. So we've pumped $200 billion, extra billion dollars into the hands of the wealthiest Americans. And it's been this stealth form of massive fiscal stimulus for the wealthy. Nobody talks about it. Hell, Tom Keene, you'll be listening to him on Bloomberg and he'll be talking about recession probabilities. And then but now we're going to take a break. Call innovationrefunds.com, call innovative taxes. He's actually advertising this stuff. It's everywhere. And, you know, they collect a contingency. Like an ambulance chasing attorney would.
Yeah.
But it's massive and real money. Now, it peaked in December and has since come off its highs, which track beautifully with hotel rates, believe it or not.
Yep.
But I mean, we're talking about six-digit income tax refunds because you get up to $26,000 per employee. Massive amounts of money that nobody wants to talk about. But again, it peaked.
But again, you know, this idea that the government can solve all the problems with stimulus, whether it be fiscal, whether it be monetary.
Not coming from this Freedom Caucus.
Right. It has worked for a while, but it's worked in all the wrong ways. As you said, it's incentivized people very deliberately to go out and spend that money, not to save it, not to pay down debt. It's been, we need to get the economy going again. We need people out spending money. And of course, when you build the economy that most Western democracies have, which is geared around consumer spending, that's a necessary evil. But again, we've reached a different point in time. We've reached a point in time where the size of the debt and the ability and the willingness to pay it down becomes more important than sustaining an economy by debt finance spending. So again, you know, we come back to this idea that we're where the rubber meets the road in something that you've been writing and talking about for a long time, as have I, as have many other people, saying there is a day of reckoning coming, and here's what it looks like. Now, it seems to me that this is what it looks like. You're running out of ways to prime the pumps. We've got this standoff now in Congress over the debt ceiling, which, you know, again, I feel sure will get resolved, But there is more jeopardy this time around. You know, my buddy Ben Davies wrote a fantastic thread about why, and I would suggest people go and read that thread at Benjamin Davis on Twitter, explaining why there is more jeopardy this time around. It's not just a simple let's cut a deal, but the quantum of them screwing this up and allowing the US to technically default, as Janet Yellen has been saying every single day on one media outlet or another, very obviously, is unthinkable. So they're going to get this done some way or somehow. But as you said, right, these refunds are only available if there are tax receipts, because that's the only funding that the government has is tax receipts. Every time I think about this, I go around in circles and I read everything you write and I listen to all your podcasts and it all makes sense, but I cannot square this circle. Something somewhere has to break. And once that one thing breaks, the whole thing falls over. And I can't figure out what the one thing to break is. And I'm hoping you can.
So I stumbled. I mean, it was blind squirrel moment. I stumbled across a headline on Friday afternoon after the market closed. This little itty bitty blurb that said Kevin McCarthy's chief of staff is abruptly resigning. He'll stay on until June 1st. I'm like, wait a minute. And this is somebody who's been doing this for 40 years, only individual in U.S. history who was two speakers' chief of staff. He was Newt Gingrich's chief of staff back in the day. So he's been doing this for 40 years. He's walking out the door. And why is he walking out the door? Well, there's a very high probability that he would also have the distinction of being the chief of staff of the first speaker of the House who was voted, that they took his gavel away, the Freedom Caucus. And they're willing to do that. And I think they will take his gavel away. So I'm a big Italian superstitious kind of a person. I believe that small headlines are very big. It was just like when Tony James retired in December 2021 from Blackstone Group as its vice chair. I'm like, okay, that 2022 vintage is not going to be pretty, because he sold DLJ, the investment bank that I worked at, to Credit Suisse at the very top of the internet bubble. And he has an uncanny timing mechanism inside of him. And he leaves on December 2021, and he's out the door. I don't think it's coincidence that Kevin McCarthy's chief of staff is quitting. And that means that things could get really awful ugly. I think the Supreme Court has known what it's going to be ruling on student debt for a while. I think it doesn't want to appear to be blatantly political. So it's going to wait, I think. I could be wrong, but I think it's going to wait until July 1st to issue its ruling. Because once it issues its ruling, then there's 60 days left until you have to start paying your student loans. That happens to coincide with the August 30th deadline that exists anyways. But I don't think they're going to try and blow up the country earlier, because that might look like they're overtly trying to hurt the Biden administration. But even so, if you talk to people about the X date, you can see it rolling along and being extended out, yelling for all of the chaos. And, you know, there's just, the world's going to end. It's going to be Armageddon. And she also said a few days ago, I'll be revising the X date here in the next few days. She'll find the money to last from June the 9th until June the 15th. You get tax receipts in eventually, you know. But can you imagine if we're talking about this in October and we're like, oh, good, California income tax receipts are finally coming in. It's October 15th. And we're still at a standoff. I mean, it'll be chaotic by then.
Well, so just for the benefit of people listening to this that aren't familiar with how the US system works, when you talk about them taking McCarthy's gavel away, just explain how that works, why the speaker is so important at this particular point in time, and how he might lose his gavel and what that might mean.
So he has four or five swing voters who held out for 16 votes. It was the highest number of votes to put a speaker of the House in his position since 1846. But these particular five holdouts, there are more people in the Freedom Caucus than these five holdouts. These are just the most extreme. And they formed this little coalition, and they, in order to seat him as speaker, they rewrote some of the language that says, we can also toss you out on your backside whenever we like. And so he's just a sitting duck. And he knows he's a sitting duck, but we also know that he's patient. And we learned that he was patient because he kept his cool over 16 votes, even though some people were saying it should be Scalise instead. Step aside. McCarthy just said, I know I'm going to get it. I don't know what price I've got to pay to get it, but I'm going to get it. So if he's that patient, then if the Biden administration keeps coming back and saying, you know, we're not going to bend, then Kevin McCarthy can just say, okay, I'm patient. and go off to Japan, enjoy yourself, safe travels at your age. Jet lag must be awful. So I'll see you when you get back into the country, but we'll just keep pushing this thing. And Janet Yellen, I mean, they're government workers. She can furlough.
So the significance, if he is booted, and it's a non-zero percent chance that he is booted, what does that do to the process? And what does that do to the Republicans' place in the kind of corridors of power, given that they have control that they didn't have before? How does this potentially upend that?
So it's obviously very tenuous control.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The reason you have to weave Fed policy back into the narrative right here at this juncture, right now, is because if the Fed does hold the line and chaos ensues in the Republican Party that has to stop all debt ceiling negotiations to elect a speaker, you can't negotiate the debt ceiling if you don't have a leader. So if that's the case, and the Fed is still kind of out there maintaining high interest rates, you end up with the risk of a massive blue wave in November of 2024. I mean, what are we, Parisians? Can we not talk about, you know, we were living longer. Can we not talk about Social Security starting at 63? And then maybe over the next 10 years, we can move that up to 65. I mean, it's not radical things to suggest that would make a big difference for the math. And that's why S&P on August the 5th, 2011, that's why they downgraded the sovereign debt, was because for all of the kabuki from 2011, and they did resolve it, they did not reform entitlement spending. So you can see a scenario where if the Fed maintains this high policy and you get a blue wave, then Fed policy can be literally hijacked.
Well, let's talk about that. I'm so glad you brought that up, because I suspect at some point we're all going to be Parisians. You know, what Macron did in France, which I have to say, I thought was incredibly brave of him to force that through. I mean, he had to force it through because he was never going to win a vote on it, not in France anyway. But to force that pension reform through, and again, as you say, raising the legal pensionable age from 62 to 64, it's not exactly a crazy thing to do. And it's something that every single developed nation in the world is going to face that same problem. Of all those countries, the one with the biggest amount of promises around that age is, of course, the United States. I mean, the estimates range from $150 trillion to $250 trillion, which just shows you how big a number it is if you can have a $100 trillion high-low. So what happens? How does that conversation get started in earnest in America in a serious way? And is there anybody who you think would be willing to force this issue through and at least bring it to the front of the national debate where it absolutely needs to be?
So my greatest fear is that the answer to that realistically is no, unless you have a different kind of wave, unless you vote everybody out and say, you know what, we're going to start from scratch. We've just been to hell and back. We've just gone through an economic contraction that makes the great financial crisis feel like a walk in the park. And we're not going to take it anymore. That would actually be a best case outcome, but the greater risk, because baby boomers are dying and no longer the biggest voting block, the greater risk is that millennials instead say, no, 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 we don't want to talk about Social Security reform. We don't want to talk about Medicare reform. We want you to pay us to not work immediately. We want universal basic income now, immediately, at which case, you know, again, Biden is actually doing something all over again. When he held Jay Powell's renomination hostage because he was trying to stack the board. So Lisa Cook's very first vote failed, 51 to 47.
Yeah.
And so they had to go back and bring Kamala Harris in and get some Democrats in the Senate chamber. And then she had to cast the tie-breaking vote. We've never seen a vice president ever in the history of the country cast a tie-breaking vote to get somebody into an independent apolitical agency. This was not a cabinet position. And, you know, he got Philip Jefferson. Philip Jefferson got 91 votes in the Senate. No wonder, but he's doing it again. But he knew that Jay Powell had gotten 83. Jay Powell, his second confirmation vote, he got 80. And these are really important details, Grant, because what he's done in the last few days is he's doing the bait and switch again. He's like, okay, I know I can get Jefferson through. for vice chair. Jefferson's actually a very thoughtful person. He actually listens. I think he's open to true reform of monetary policy, something that would take us off this roller coaster. But Biden knows that he got those 91 votes. So who does he nominate as well? Well, Lisa Cook managed to get those 51 votes simply because it was for a governor position that was ending in 2024. In one fell swoop, Biden has thrown in her name for a position that will last for 14 years if she gets, again, the votes, plus Akerlof's protege. Now, Akerlof is also known as Mr. Janet Yellen. He's a UC Berkeley educated labor economist, just like Janet Yellen. He also gave an interview for Der Spiegel in 2003, in which he said that also because of climate change, that George W. Bush was the worst president in 200 years. His protege, she had him advise on her dissertation at UC Berkeley, has been nominated to the Fed board. If the board can be stacked in the opposite image of the US Supreme Court, then we could see the blue wave, get rid of Powell, and then that's it. It's game over. It's hyperinflation. I'm like, well, if I'm going to live in a socialist country, I might as well call it Italy. It's cheaper.
And the food's better.
And that's good because Zoom works anywhere. So we can chat. I'll be in Florence. You'll be wherever you are. Yeah, the state of Texas where I am will secede.
Yeah.
And it will.
That I can see happening. And that's what happens at these periods of great change. And when tectonic plates really start to move as they are now, you can feel it happening. But I want to go back to something you mentioned there, because it's something that I've been thinking a lot about and talking a lot about recently. And I had a conversation about it last week at an event I was speaking at. And that's this changing of the guard on the policy side. You know, this it's not just a changing of the guard from red to blue. This is a generational change. And the idea that the boomer generation are, as you said, either dying out or will eventually leave politics. Many of them, I would imagine, in boxes because there's no term limits. My generation, Gen X, get passed over like they always do, which is totally fine. We've gotten used to that. And so the power is going to be handed to the millennial generation. And we all know that if you are a millennial politician looking to get millennial votes, we know what you're going to have to promise, right? You're going to have to promise, as you said, no reneging on promises made to you. In fact, more promises, because this is how democracy works nowadays. So how is it even remotely possible, once that transformation and that transition takes place, it may not be this election cycle, but it's likely to be the next one, how does that possibly take place? Because, as you say, this all points to dramatic inflation. And, you know, whenever you talk about hyperinflation, people kind of go, oh, well, now you've gone too far, because we'll never have hyperinflation in somewhere like the United States or the UK. This is not Argentina, for God's sake. But, of course, we're just past the point where everybody that remembers hyperinflation in Germany, at that time, one of the world's most advanced nations. Everyone that remembers that is just about died out now. So it does happen. So how does that all come together? How does this transition of power from boomers to millennials and the picking up the baton of the millennials' case by politicians trying to make things better for that generation at the expense of boomers, what does that look like? Because everywhere I look, I just see conflict.
It looks like a very, very, very busy Supreme Court.
Yeah, great point.
And truly, because all of a sudden checks and balances will matter again, a lot, like our founding father type matter. And you will see things like Texas. I say it tongue in cheek, but you know, we've had almost, I want to say 805,000, our growth in the 12 years through like 2021. And that growth, we don't have the census data for the time that followed it, but we know that after COVID. So now we're in the running to be the most populous state. We're in the running to be the biggest economy. California is bleeding its tax base. And if you have this blue wave and the federal authorities say you must pay higher federal income taxes to bail out Illinois, New Jersey, New York, and California, all these places that have bled population, their pensions are a train wreck. You're going to have to bail them out. We're raising your federal income taxes. I wouldn't be surprised if Florida was like, hey, we're just angling in the ocean here. We're out too. Because that's what I keep trying to tell people, is that what we're witnessing with this migration is societal. It's societal in nature. It's not just economics. in nature. Look, the teachers' unions, California, Illinois, New York, these students, they've lost 3 years of learning.
Yeah.
The parents are really mad. Some of them moved to Texas and into Florida, not just because of no state income tax, but because they had no say in their own child's education and whether it be completely run off the rails. It's the stuff of civil strife, the current migration that we're seeing. That's what we're watching. I mean, right before I came on with you, I saw this headline go by about the danger of Chicago's abandoned skyscrapers. And that was the word that was used. It wasn't like this could be economically damaging to the Chicago economy. It wasn't that. It was bigger in scope and in scale.
Well, this idea of secession, it's funny that you bring that up because it's a word that was used very much from a historical concept for many, many years. There was never any forward-looking idea of secession. But obviously, the more this has gone on, we've looked at Europe. We've seen Britain secede from the European Union. Again, another thing that most people said that there's no way that will happen when that referendum came out. And once people were given the opportunity to talk, now whether it's a smart move or a dumb move, time will tell. Both sides are sticking to their guns. But the very fact that you and I can sit here and have a thoughtful conversation about the idea of Texas seceding from the Union and potentially Florida going with them.
It even sounds good, right? Texas. I mean, I just thought about that. It even fits with the spelling of the state's name. You just have to change A-S to I-T, Texas.
There you go. There you go. And so when you think about the changes that have to have happened almost imperceptibly to many, that you and I, who, you know, I know you're a sensible, level-headed person, and I try to be, the fact that you and I can sit here and have this conversation in a real sense, not in a kind of game theory, theoretical, or what would it take for the dominoes of this to happen, but that could be the first domino rather than the last domino, tells you an awful lot about just how far down this road we've traveled.
It has. And if you think about the timing, because the timing is kind of crucial, Mexico right now has a president that has tried to run its economy into the ground. And when is AMLO gone? In 2 years. So you have a situation where if I'm the powers that be in the state of Texas, I'm like, wait a minute, that's not the United States trading with Mexico anymore. That's not a United States-Mexico treaty. By far, Texas is the biggest exporting state. The port of Houston is the fastest growing. They're pumping LNG out to Europe. And Europe's managed to, the light bulbs went on. So now they've got floating LNG terminals because they couldn't spend the money or the time to wait to build them in the ground traditionally. But I mean, you could see Texas saying, well, we'd be a pretty damn powerful nation. I mean, but by the time 2 years rolls around, they'll probably be the 10th largest nation in the world on a standalone basis. Right now, Texas is the 11th largest nation in the world on a standalone basis. California is still 9. But California is getting to be really expensive.
Yeah,
and it looks like we're gonna it looks like it's gonna be the red states bailing out the blue states, and I just don't see, given the two individuals right now who are named to run for president in 2024, I just don't see it being a peaceful transition to our income tax rates being doubled at the federal level.
No, look, it's exactly right, and this idea of trying to reconcile and find some middle ground between ideologies that are just moving farther and farther apart with every passing decision that gets made. It's shocking to me that we've reached this point, but we have. And so we have to deal with it, not just from a policy, monetary policy standpoint, but as you say, and you quite rightly bring up, this idea that away from monetary policy, once we get into politic policy, you realize that the battle lines are well and truly drawn. They're drawn between left and right. They're drawn between young and old. They're drawn between rich and poor. And all of those conflicts kind of have an intersection in the middle there, which is kind of where the rational man tries to stand. And you get whiplash, your head gets spun around so fast by all of this. So as you try and do that,
think about for a minute the octogenarians we have running Congress in D.C., and then contrast that with how relatively young Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, are.
Texas, yeah.
They're young and popular. They both have presidential aspirations. Abbott's not going to get there. It doesn't look like DeSantis is either. But I'm just saying the states where economic activity is vibrant, they have younger leaders.
Yeah. Daniel, let me ask you this. How do you do what you do and sit in the middle of all this? Because I think this would be really useful for people to understand. How do you maintain a level head, maintain as dispassionate a view as you possibly can when trying to analyze all these different cross currents? How do you mentally deal with that? Because it's not an easy thing to do. And I think most people struggle with it. So you seem to fare better than most. Talk a little bit about how you take in this information, process it, and come up with sensible answers rather than answers colored by prejudice or beliefs or a stance on a given issue.
Well, a few months ago, because my brain was just, I felt this crushing sensation, this pressure. And a few months ago, I let go of needing to find one historic corollary, because we are in 2007. We are in 1999. We are in 1933. And that's the part that tells me that the aggregate of where we are historically is, and we are in 2011. Sorry, we're also in 2011. Yeah. So in recession, by the way. So again, I argue that when we see the final writing on the wall, that 2022 will look more robust and that 2023 will look weaker. So you have to broaden your perspective and appreciate historically that we're in uncharted territory. And that's why it's good to sometimes sit down and talk to people like Neil Howe, because you want to talk about level-headed. I mean, my gosh, he's really level-headed. I just saw him last week. So you have to appreciate that you could go from a situation where, you know, you're going to have to position yourself for deflation to you could flip a switch and have to flip your portfolio on its head and position for hyperinflation. And, you know, in such scenarios, you know, when there are crises of this magnitude, I don't care what, there's a new coin out there. I don't know. Anyways, gold performs, period. And if for some reason in the background, the Federal Reserve maintains high interest rates, you know, you could go to your bunker safely.
Yeah.
And try and wait out the storm. And then you have a scenario where, again, if this can so easily backfire on the Republicans, if it's a deep enough recession and the millennials come out and vote, we could be there in a heartbeat. We're talking about less than 18 months.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, at the end of the day, you have to think about the positives through all this. And in history, and you bring up Neil Howe there, you know, every time we've reached a period like this, a fourth turning, Neil's provided all the evidence you need that once you get through this, and it's going to be painful to get through this period, and it's going to require people to accept a much lower standard of living. In fact, the Bank of England came out a couple of weeks ago and said, you know, one of the governors said, well, people have to understand that they're poorer than they think they are. And there was uproar. You know, this guy, you know, Bank of England policymaker tells truth. And, you know, shock, horror, opprobrium follows from every angle. But we do get through these, and it's going to require a rethinking of politics. It's going to require a readjustment of our standards of living and what we expect. And we've seen some of that through COVID and some of the things that we've had to kind of get used to in terms of, you know, not being able to get access to everything we want at a cheap price. But it's a process. And, you know, you have to kind of, as you've said, maintain a level head throughout, listen to people who are equally level-headed, and just try and have a plan for all eventualities, because that's pretty much what's on the table now. I mean, literally anything could happen from here on.
It is. And the good news is I don't think, you know, after having this, because I never, the word Texit never crossed my mind literally until I'm sitting here chatting with you. It's just a real-time epiphany. And I just said to myself, well, this is good. I don't have to move.
There you go. There's always a silver lining. Well, that's great. Listen, Daniel, before we finish, let everybody know a bit more about QI. Give your work a plug there, because it's fantastic stuff. And anyone listening who isn't familiar with it, I'm sure most of them will be, but give them a chance to understand where to find you and how to find you.
So I basically do for clients what I did for Richard Fisher those 9 years at the Fed with QI research. I published my first weekly 5 days after I left the Fed in June of 2015. And we've just been building up our lineup ever since then. We're very protective of our product. We have discounted it one time, and there's actually a link that Grant's going to send you that'll give you 20% off of our annual. We call it a retail product. Our retail clients tell us it's not a retail product. They say it's an institutional daily product. Great, wonderful. Then you get it for a really cheap price. So he'll send out the link, dimartinoboots.substack.com, with a special Williams link in it that'll give you 20% off the annual. And then follow me on Twitter at DiMartino Booth. If I could figure out how to tweet with my eyes closed, I probably would. I don't tweet as much as I used to, but then when, you know, every time a bank fails, I seem to be very popular. But at Diakono Booth is its own, they say it's a free MBA. So I guess I'm giving something away for free. And if you're interested on the institutional side, then that's different. Go on QIresearch.com and you'll find the link to institutional. But I'm going to plug myself for a different reason. People ask me all the time why I spend so much time going through history, whether it's the start of the daily, which is just a paragraph, or whether it's the start of the weekly, which can sometimes be almost a page. If I lose historical context, then my perspective as somebody telling you how to position yourself is meaningless.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with that more. Well, listen, thank you. It's been a fantastic hour. I promise you, if you secede from the union, I will still come to Texas because it's a fantastic place. I may have to get a visa, but I will go through those hoops just to come back to Texas. Danielle, thank you so much for your time.
We'll even let you visit Mexico from time to time.
There you go. All right. Well, maybe you guys should just get together and become Texaco. That would make life easier for all of us.
There you go. Got a ring to it.
All right. Listen, take care of yourself, and I'm sure our paths will cross somewhere in the world soon. I look forward to that.
Likewise, Grant. Good to see you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, my thanks to Danielle for another fantastic conversation. It's always interesting to get her perspective, particularly given so much is now focused on the actions taken by the Fed at a point where, as we said during that conversation, the rubber really is meeting the road and we're starting to see those pressure points arrive that many people have been predicting would come around for well over a decade now. So my thanks to Danielle for taking the time to do that. Again, if you want to follow her on Twitter, you'll find her at DMartinoBooth, and she's a very good follower if you don't follow already. She did give us a coupon for the first time ever. She's discounting her subscription to her annual product on Substack. The link for that will be in the transcript, so I would urge you to take advantage of that and sign up for her service. It's incredibly well-respected, and everyone that I know that uses it speaks incredibly highly of it. So with that being said, I will bid you farewell. My thanks to you, as always, for listening. I will be back with another podcast in the very near future. Take care. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So, while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.